This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Catherine Graham. Coming up on the program, why a province in Solomon Islands is refusing to do business with any company linked to China. Also, after 2,269 days in Papua New Guinea, the refugee and author Behrouz Bachani is now in New Zealand.
The future for Behrouz is limitless. You know, he's, as you know, he was saying to me, he's overcome the impression of Australia, the billions of dollars that have been spent to stifle his voice, and he's found a voice of millions and millions of people around the world.
And why a small Pacific nation declared a public holiday to celebrate a win over the Australian Kangaroos, but it's not been enough to resolve a standoff within the sport of rugby league in Tonga. Those stories and more coming up here on Pacific Review. But first, a retired Australian judge this week took unprecedented steps and spoke out publicly to say that he believes the anti-government protest group that's known widely as the Nauru 19 will not get a fair trial. The now retired judge, Jeffrey Mukey, initially presided over their case in Nauru, but he was sacked last year, shortly after he threw the prosecution of the protesters out of court. A retrial began this week, but as Anthony Stewart reports, two members of the group aren't there. Instead, they're seeking political asylum in Australia.
The so-called Nauru 19 have faced prosecution since June 2015. The group, which included a former president and includes a government minister and parliamentarians, was charged over anti-government protests that year. Successive Nauruan governments have sought to have them jailed. Retired Judge Jeff Mukey presided over part of the case. He's now turned whistleblower.
I, as a judge or a retired judge, would never do what I'm doing now in the normal course. It's not the role of a judge, even a retired judge, to speak on the public record as I am now. But I was so ashamed of what is happening in the judicial system on the island, let alone the executive government. I am doing it in the hope, but not the expectation, that it may help the Nauru 19 or what's left of them.
While serving on Nauru's Supreme Court, Justice Mukey ordered a permanent stay on the Nauru 19 proceedings. He was then sacked by the government. Jeffrey Mukey says Nauru has deliberately passed laws to limit the Nauru 19's access to legal representation, and this means they'll never get a fair trial.
Not now, no. No one could run this trial if he was representing, he or she was representing all of the accused.
Have you ever seen, as a judge, have you ever seen conduct like this?
Never. Never. And it came as a shock to me that this conduct does or can exist in what otherwise are considered to be democratic communities where the rule of law is said by the Minister for Justice to be honoured and be applied to every Nauruan citizen.
Australian aid and payments to operate the Immigration Detention Centre in Nauru represent a significant portion of the nation's budget. The retired judge says given Australia's financial support, the Commonwealth should consider intervening.
They should take some responsibility for ensuring that the rule of law operates in the country which they support to such a huge extent.
It's also been revealed two members of the Nauru 19 have sought political asylum in Australia. Squire Jeremiah and his cousin Rutherford are both former Nauruan MPs. He says they both fled to Australia when restrictions on their passports were briefly lifted.
Their own people are fleeing their country. That this never happened to Nauru. This is the first time in the history that Nauruans are running away from their own countries. They're putting in a system that they brought in people from Fiji to dictate and deliver what they want. What they want is nothing but persecuting people.
Stephen Lawrence has previously acted as a lawyer for the group, but he says they will not have any representation at this hearing.
There is no prospect of the Nauru 19 receiving a fair trial. We will see, maybe for the first time in this region, a mass trial of criminal accused who will take no meaningful part in their trial. They've been denied legal representation. The Nauru government has spent a small fortune on prosecutors. At no point have they spent a cent on the defence.
The trial is expected to take 2 weeks, but if the group is convicted, they'll likely be housed in a newly opened jail. Squire Jeremiah again.
According to David Adeng and Baron Wanga, they make fun about it. They tell people that this jail has been funded by Australia, built for the persecution of Nauru 19.
The Nauruan government did not respond to PacBeat's request for comment.
It's Anthony Stewart reporting. In the Solomon Islands, the government's still dealing with the fallout of its decision earlier this year to switch its diplomatic allegiances from Taiwan to China. And one province is pushing back against the move. It's refusing to do business or allow development projects involving the Chinese government or companies that are linked to China. This province is Malaita Province, and it's also renewing calls for autonomy. It wants more of a say in how it's being run, as Evan Wasuka reports.
2 months ago, Solomon Islands caught international attention when it cut diplomatic ties with Taiwan and switched to China. While that decision has been accepted by many, it didn't go down well in the country's most populated province of Malaita. Philip Subu is a youth advocate in the provincial capital, Auki.
There is certainly anti-China sentiment expressed here in Malaita by the youth and also the general populace as a whole.
That sentiment has only grown stronger and has been formalized in a communique by Malaita's provincial assembly. In it, the province has decided not to accept any development by China or commercial companies linked to the Chinese government. Celsus Talifilu is a researcher and advisor to Malaita's premier.
Any connection, whether directly or indirectly, to the Chinese Communist Party, the Malaita province will not allow that entity to enter its boundaries.
Mr. Talifilu says it all comes back to the decision by Prime Minister Manase Sokovare and his cabinet to dump Taiwan in favour of China.
The position of the Malaita provincial government is really about the failure of the national government to appropriate and proper consultation before they made the switch.
Malaita is one of Solomon Islands 9 provinces, and with a population of around 150,000, it's also the most populated. Dr. John Frankel is a professor of comparative politics at the University of Victoria in New Zealand.
You bear in mind that about 70 or 80% of the population in Honiara are from the island of Malaita, or at least descended from those from the island of Malaita. It's a very large and powerful province numerically, and also it's a province which has always been right at the centre of Solomon Islands politics, along with Guadalcanal and the Western Province.
As part of its pushback against the national government, Malaita is also seeking autonomy. Celsus Talifilu says it's one of the conditions in the Malaita communique.
If that is what the people of Malaita province aspired for, then it's only right that the provincial government would facilitate such thinking, of course, with the international community, under arrangements that are legal and lawful.
Since the mid-2000s, Solomon Islands has been looking at a federal constitution that would give more power and control to the provinces, but work on it has only reached a draft stage. Dr. Joseph Fourcorne is a researcher at the University of South Pacific in Vanuatu. He says while the trigger for the current standoff is China, the issue is actually a long-standing one about power being too centralized with the national government.
How power is being accessed at the national level, and it's not devolved down to the provincial level as it should be. And also in terms of how development is captured, it goes down straight from the national MPs down to the constituents.
As for the national government, Deputy Prime Minister Manase Maelanga, who recently led a delegation to the province, says the government respects Malaita's position on China. But with Parliament to meet next week, Dr. John Frankel from Victoria University says it'll be interesting to see if the differences within the province will also feed into national politics.
The peculiarity of the Solomon Islands, but both that a government decision on a switch like that causes such deliberation, such consternation, and also that it goes down to the local level in this kind of way.
It's Dr. John Frankel from the University of Wellington in New Zealand. Evan Wasuka, our reporter. Well, after 2,269 days, or just over 6 years, mostly in Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, the refugee and author Behrouz Bichani is now in New Zealand. And perhaps not surprisingly, he's vowed never to return to PNG. Mr. Bichani was, of course, sent to PNG and Manus Island as part of Australia's offshore processing policy. He travelled to Christchurch this week to speak at a literary event, and he says he's considering applying for asylum there. David Sparks reports.
Iranian asylum seeker Behrouz Bichani stepped off the plane in New Zealand looking exhausted but very happy, and his supporters were thrilled.
Hello, sir. So good to see you.
After his six-year ordeal in Papua New Guinea, no one there begrudged his very human impulse once his feet hit the ground.
I think I should have a smoke first. I don't know.
Behrouz Bichani received a visitor's visa to travel to Christchurch to speak at a literary event about his award-winning book, No Friend But the Mountains. He first had to receive temporary travel documents and permission from the PNG Immigration Department. And he says he's proud to have survived immigration detention.
You know, for years we look at Australia as a New Zealand, as a hope. But this hope was sometimes was very close, but we couldn't touch it, you know.
The refugee famously typed his book in a series of WhatsApp messages while in detention on Manus Island. It was an account of his often dangerous journey to Christmas Island and his subsequent incarceration on Manus. He's considering applying for asylum in New Zealand, but another possibility is to travel to the United States, where he was recently accepted for resettlement. Amnesty International's Tim O'Connor has known Mr. Bichani since 2013.
You know, as Behrouz says, he's finally feels like a free man. The future for Behrouz is limitless. You know, he's, as you know, he was saying to me, he's overcome the oppression of Australia, the billions of dollars that have been spent to stifle his voice, and he's found a voice of millions and millions of people around the world. Behrouz's future is very bright, and it's much brighter today than it has been certainly for the last 7 years.
That's Amnesty International's Tim O'Connor, the reporter David Sparks. There's a new warning that Pacific wildlife are being caught up in an illegal pet market in Asia. It comes after police in the Philippines recently intercepted a shipment of more than 300 animals, with birds that are endemic to both the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea among them. Experts say it's the advent of online platforms that's making it easier for buyers to pick and choose exotic pets, and the rarer the better for many buyers, as Evan Wasuka explains.
That's the cry of the black lorry. It's endemic to Papua New Guinea as well as other parts of Australia. It's also one of the species of birds that was intercepted in the Philippines, believed to have been smuggled in by way of Papua New Guinea and Indonesia on its way to international buyers. Karen Beard works with the Secretariat of Pacific Regional Environment Program in Samoa. She says the demand for exotic and rare animals as pets in Asia, the Middle East and other parts of the world make Pacific wildlife attractive.
They're particularly interested in species like parrots and cockatoos, even hornbills. There's a big trade, not in the Pacific, but in other parts of the world.
The main treaty that protects wildlife is the UN Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, commonly known as CITES. Ms. Beard works with SPREP and governments in the Pacific to enforce CITES and enable the legal trade in wildlife by building the capacity of governments.
The legal trade in wildlife requires that for you to be able to endorse trade in a particular species, you need to be able to show that the impact on the wildlife population, for example, is not going to be detrimental to its survival.
By having better regulations and enforcement, it's hoped that this will reduce the illegal trade in the Pacific. But they're up against tough odds. In recent years, the illegal pet trade has become a booming business. Kanithna Krishnasamy is the Southeast Asian Director for Traffic, an organization fighting the illegal wildlife trade.
We've got social media and online trade that has become the new favoured medium because it's easy enough to acquire birds. You simply look at your phone and you can make an inquiry, you can make a purchase, you never have to leave your home, and the animal that you want arrives in your house. And that really is one of the biggest challenges that law enforcement agencies face today. everything.
Under CITES, animals bred in captivity can be traded. But with online sales, which are mostly unregulated, there's no clear way of enforcing this. Ms. Krishnasamy says there's really no way of knowing how many Pacific creatures end up for sale. And the worrying trend is that sales are increasing.
Not just older individuals that are interested in hobbies. You're getting a lot of younger generation. And I mean, you know, people as young as teenagers who are also interested in acquiring an animal. And they often don't know that a vast majority of this is actually legal.
Dr. Patrick Pikacha is a prominent conservationist in Melanesia and is a researcher at the Pacific Adventist University in Papua New Guinea. He's seen firsthand the illegal trade in wildlife.
In the field, I've seen hornbill getting shipped up to Honiara, parrots being sent from places like Makira, especially endemic species, especially species that are only found in certain sites.
But Dr. Pikacha says governments can do their part by encouraging and setting up local communities to breed these rare species in captivity.
This is actually a potential industry where local people may be provided training and professional help to build proper captive breeding facilities to provide captive bred wildlife to markets overseas.
See conservationist and scientist Dr. Patrick Pikacha, Evan Wasuka reporting. Well, senior journalists from across the Pacific say regional governments are looking abroad at the poor treatment of media in other countries, including Australia, and copying what they're seeing back at home. Journalists and editors from Melanesian countries, so Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea, Fiji and Vanuatu, are so concerned that they came together this week to come up with ways to improve media freedom in the region. Liam Fox reports.
Papua New Guinea is a tough place to be a journalist at the best of times. But Scott Wideay from MTV says things are particularly difficult at the moment, and not just in PNG, but other Melanesian countries as well.
We're on a dangerous downward trend, and many of those who've come from Melanesian countries have been persecuted by their governments, are either arrested or questioned or intimidated.
Mr. Wideay is one of PNG's most respected journalists. Last year, MTV suspended him after he aired a story critical of the government's decision to purchase a fleet of luxury cars for the APEC conference. He was later reinstated after a widespread public backlash. Mr. Wideay believes the increasingly difficult media environment is directly connected to the Chinese government's growing influence in the region and its restrictions on media back home.
Pacific governments are also seeing what can be done to the media and the possibilities, and taking notes from the Chinese government, basically, and using some of those methods, like clampdowns on the media, intimidating. I'm not saying China's directly telling them to do it, but I mean, people watch, people learn.
Dan McGarry from Vanuatu agrees, but believes it's not just China that Pacific governments are taking their cues from.
They can see just as easily as you and I can what's happening in Hong Kong, what's happening in the United States, and in Australia. I mean, you know, the raids on journalists, on their private homes. You know, if I were, you know, a leader and I didn't want people talking about me and I saw others doing things like this, you know, I definitely want to take a page from their book.
Until last week, he was the media director of the Vanuatu Daily Post newspaper, but the government refused to renew his work permit. Mr. McGarry, a Canadian who's lived in Vanuatu for 16 years, has no doubt it's because of his critical coverage of government activities. In particular, the deportation of six Chinese nationals in July, four of whom had Vanuatu citizenship without due process or access to lawyers. He says there's always been friction between the media and those in power in the region, but the dynamic has changed.
Now what we're seeing is the tools of the state being used as a lever in order to stifle and suppress the freedom of expression and the media in particular.
He cites his own case as an example, but also the recent expulsion of a 60 Minutes crew from Kiribati and the laying of sedition charges against the Fiji Times, charges the newspaper beat in court last year. Mr. McGarry and Mr. Wideay were among a group of senior journalists, editors and broadcasters who gathered at Griffith University in Brisbane this week for the Melanesia Media Freedom Forum. Also there was Jane Worthington, Regional Director of the International Federation of Journalists.
The fact that the media industry in this region is so small makes it one of the toughest tasks for journalists. Like, not only do they have funding problems and issues, they are eyeballing governments and politicians and local business heavyweights on a day-to-day basis. So there's no easy escape for journalists. They're very much in the firing line.
It's Jane Worthington from the International Federation of Journalists, Liam Fox reporting. Well, Friday was a public holiday in the Pacific Kingdom of Tonga, declared by the government as a way to celebrate the historic wins of its rugby league team over Australia and Great Britain in recent weeks. Now, it was a public holiday despite the fact that the small country is battling a measles outbreak. This week, the government ordered all of its primary schools to close, in fact, for several weeks as it tries to stop the spread of the highly infectious virus. Meanwhile, though, this historic win of the rugby league team doesn't appear to have provided a resolution to an ongoing standoff between a suspended national rugby league board in Tonga and the head coach, Christian Wolfe, who was actually sacked. Kelvin Anthony explains.
Can't really explain the feeling right now. It's been a long journey for us. We've come a long way. We weren't too sure that we were going to get a game this year, but... full credit to the fans out here that have been here since day one.
That was CEO Siua Tau Keiao trying to express his emotions after he led the Tongan Invitational 13 to pull off one of the biggest upsets in rugby league history.
Beating New Zealand in 2017 was big. Last week was big. This is huge.
In the weeks leading up to the game, the team wasn't even certain it'd be competing due to the major differences between the sports governing body in Tonga and its overseas-based coach and players. But after some controversy and a suspension handed down to TNRL by Rugby League International Federation, they ended up playing a test match against Great Britain and a week later against the best team in the world, Australia. They won both the games, and following the team's success, the government declared a public holiday. The TNRL has mixed feelings. Their secretary William Edwards maintains they don't have any issues with the players representing the country.
You've got to take your hat off to a group of players who played under the Tonga banner and succeeded very, very well. But our dispute has nothing to do with their performance. Their playing the game had nothing to do with our rights being infringed by the international body.
However, Jason Taumalolo, one of the most senior players, has come out publicly saying that the harm done by the TNRL executives is unreconcilable. Mr. Edwards disagrees.
Our dispute lies with the international body and suspended the membership of TNRL.
Christian Wolfe, the coach who's at the centre of the controversy, said that for Tonga Rugby League to be successful, the current set of administrators need to go. In a statement released on Wednesday, Mr. Wolfe said,
"We have now exhibited our potential on the world stage, and to reach that full potential, we need new governance. If we want to reach our full potential at the 2021 Rugby League World Cup in England, which is to win that tournament, we must have that reform now."
However, Mr. Edwards says Mr. Wolfe, who was sacked from his position, needs to stop making comments against TNRL and its affairs.
Never have I ever seen in my whole life as a former player and as a former administrator a coach open his mouth and demand change. If he did that in Australia, he would have been sacked straight away. Why is it that we're getting pushed around by coach? He's not the coach of TNR.
The conflict reached its peak when the Tongan Prime Minister intervened with a letter to the Rugby League International Federation. They call for the TNRL board to be suspended and a counter-organisation, the Tonga Ma Tonga Rugby League, or TMTRL, to be endorsed as an interim board. Serious financial mismanagement concerns were raised by the players, who also threatened to boycott all international fixtures. But as investigations continue against the current board, Mr. Edwards says their suspension is unlawful and maintains the board's innocence. He says the TNRL is seeking legal advice on the issue and they will not back down from going on a legal fight with the Rugby League International Federation.
If they find that we did something wrong in their investigation, then we might have to take further steps there. If our lawyers file proceedings, which we're hoping to do, and we succeed, then our membership's restored, and that means that the TNTRL, they call themselves, have got no standing. They can't interfere with us.
It's William Edwards there. He's from the Tonga National Rugby League Board. Kelvin Anthony reporting there. That is all for Pacific Review this week. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, if you do like listening to news about the Pacific, we have a program called Pacific Beat. It's on every day, Monday through to Friday, on ABC Radio Australia. You can also find us online. Just type ABC and Pacific Beat into your search engine. You'll find our page. We're also on the ABC Listen app. You can stream ABC Radio Australia live. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company.